You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to a filmmaker whose latest documentary looks at religious architecture around the United States, including here in Wisconsin. Now, the UW system was planning to survey students this spring at its campuses about how they feel about their freedom of speech and expression. Last week, that survey was postponed until the fall after some questions were raised about how it was going to be put into effect, and UW-Whitewater Interim Chancellor Jim Henderson resigned in part as a result. The topic of free speech on college campuses is hotly contested around the country, and organizers of the UW survey say it's important to collect data on the issue to inform policy decisions. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see the UW system survey its students about freedom of speech and freedom of expression? Have you checked out the survey questions that are out there? What do you think? If you work on a campus, if you're a student on a campus, are these hot topics for you right now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Timothy Shields, a professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Stout. He's director of the Menard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation, the organization planning to lead the free speech survey in conjunction with other academic groups in the state. Tim, welcome back to Central Time.
Good afternoon, Rob. Thanks for having me on the show.
Can you talk about the origins for this survey, first of all?
I can, but to do that, I have to take you back about 30 years.
Sure.
That's how long I've been a free speech scholar doing free speech research. So this wasn't something that just popped out of thin air on a whim. I've done a First Amendment survey of Wisconsin citizens some years ago, too. So, again, this didn't pop out of thin air. The reason it happened right now is I've been thinking about doing something like this for a couple of years, and I didn't have the funding available. Some of our projects for this year, in part due to COVID, didn't come through. So I found myself with extra funding, and I had met people recently that would be good partners in this. So it was the right time to do it.
And when I say survey, I mean, this isn't exactly the sort of public opinion survey people might be used to seeing. I think this is coming from kind of an academic angle. Can you talk about what you're trying to find out and how you're trying to find it out?
Sure. So many people are probably familiar with the controversies about here. You know, so some people think there's not enough viewpoint diversity on campus. Some people think that's fine. Some people think students are staying quiet because they're afraid of professors indoctrinating them, and other people think that's not a problem. And right now, it's just all speculation, really. And so, the point of the survey is let's try to get some data. Like any survey, it's just a snapshot. It's not the end of the story. It's sort of the start of more research. We could find out more about what's going on.
There's a concern. I think you mentioned there's controversy. I think there's a concern that, there are a lot of questions on here. People from anywhere on the political spectrum are likely to take one or two of those questions and use them as a political cudgel. Do you worry about how, even whatever your intent here, how the results could be politicized?
No. 30 years doing free speech, you can't do this and not run into controversies. You can't run into people who want to turn things to fit their own agenda. What we're hoping, though, is that when people discuss free speech after the survey, they'll have some data points they have to refer back to. They won't be able to just, blindly talk past them based on anecdotes or personal biases or assumptions.
Now, if this had gone ahead as scheduled, I believe it was last week, if someone's a UW student on any campus, what would they have seen? How would they have been approached? What would be in their hands to fill out?
They would have gotten an email from some office on campus. I think there were some variations in campuses who was sending the email, but somebody from their campus, maybe the dean of students, maybe the registrar, would have sent an email with blanket basic introduction to the email, to the survey, and a Qualtrics link. That link would have taken them into the survey then. It would have had the usual kind of, consent language, and then students could have proceeded to share their perceptions.
And then, of course, the question is, it didn't happen last week. What is your read, or what led you to postpone this to the fall?
Really, it's simple. There just were too many questions to answer in too short an order for it to launch on time. We want to be as transparent as possible. We want to be as upfront with people as possible. There's some legitimate questions being asked. There's no point in trying to force it without people really understanding what's going on. So, I really appreciate this opportunity to try to share a broader message about the survey.
Talking to Timothy Scheel, professor of philosophy at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, creator of this free speech survey scheduled to go out last week to students at UW campuses around the state, postponed now till the fall. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions, what you would want to know from a survey like this at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rose is with us in Menominee Falls. Rose, hello.
Hi there. I have no objection whatsoever to doing a valid study and collecting the kind of data that the guest is talking about. However, it reeks of political theater when it's spent and bought and paid for by a very well-known political entity. And so it right off the bat, it taints the whole validity of the study as far as I'm concerned. And if they really want good, real data, they should commission it from the university itself.
Rose, thanks for the call. Rose raising questions about the funding of the survey, pointing toward the Menard Center. I think people have talked about it being funded by somebody who leans, it's fair to say, conservative. What do you say to address those concerns, Timothy?
Well, two things. It is system doing it. The Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service is a unit of UW system, and they're the ones actually conducting the survey. Mm-hmm. The funding, well, we have the name Menard, but we're not a spokesperson for the Menard's point of view. We're an academic center, and we have academic freedom. I don't ask for their approval on any of the projects I do. I've had no correspondence with them whatsoever about this survey. It's my research area. I wanted to pursue it. I am.
Rose, thanks for the call at 800-642-1234. Chris joins us now in Milwaukee. Chris, hi.
Hi. You know, I am so tired of the right complaining about not getting their free speech rights when I couldn't possibly get a left point of view on any AM radio station in the city. Free speech is only supposed to be for people on the right, and the people on the left are just supposed to be quiet. Thank you for listening.
Chris, thanks a lot for the call. Tim, you are focusing on campuses in particular, not the general media and opinion landscape. Can you talk about, as you said, you've been at this for a while, talk about the importance of free speech issues on campuses in particular?
Well, first, I guess I want to back up and say free speech isn't for any particular side. The whole point of free speech is free speech for we, not free speech for me. So on campuses, there's some concern. We don't know whether it's legitimate or not about the left sort of having control of the conversation. Off campus, there's concern about the right having control of the conversation. All that's outside of our control. We simply want to collect data to try to get some idea of what's actually going on. Again, it's just a snapshot. It's just one survey. One survey doesn't prove anything. It's a starting point for a more informed conversation.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. I read through the questions, Tim. It covers a lot of ground. What are some of the things you're most interested to hear about to maybe frame, as you say, frame future research?
Well, several things. So one of the things our survey done that isn't often done, or I'm not sure if it's ever been done, is we have a little section asking what knowledge of the First Amendment students have, because we're interested in part in that on its own merits, you know, how much do they understand about their own rights. But we also are curious whether that has any correlation to their perceptions of the free speech situation on campus, to their views about viewpoint diversity on campus into their perceptions of self-censorship on campus.
We're talking about a planned free speech survey on UW campuses with one of the organizers, Tim Scheel, director of the Menard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation at UW-Stout, where he is a philosophy professor. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. The study, as we've mentioned, the survey was delayed until the fall. Are you hoping it ends up going forward? What are you hoping to learn from it? Are you a college student, a parent thereof, or do you work on a campus? What do you think about free speech on college campuses? Do you think that students are generally able to freely express their opinions or viewpoints? Do you have questions for our guest about the survey and what we're hoping to get out of it? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Right now we're picking up our talk with UW-Stout Professor Tim Scheel. He is the organizer of a free speech survey for students on all UW system campuses, scheduled to be released last week, postponed now until the fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you hoping this survey goes forward in the fall? What do you want to know about what students are experiencing when it comes to, and thinking for that matter, when it comes to freedom of expression and freedom of speech on campuses? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now. Gene in Wales. Gene, hi.
How you doing? I was concerned. I got on the web and I read the whole survey, and you know, first of all, it's coming from a part of the university that an agency that was initially started with the Koch brothers' money and now Menard's money. So we have some interesting dynamics going on there. But what bothered me was when the students would have been done with this anonymous survey, they needed to say or was suggested, like, which party are you involved with, and some demographic data about the person filling out the form. And then it was the beginning of the survey said that only five people, or the people on the top of this form, would be the only people looking at this data that would be generated from this survey. So I'm concerned that this becomes a database that somebody else could use down the road.
I gotcha. Thanks for the call. Tim, did you want to, before getting into his main question, did you want to tackle what he brought up about funding?
Again, I would encourage you, if you are worried about our hidden agenda or something, that you go to our website at the uwstout.csii and look at our actual programming, look at what we actually fund, and you'll see there's no hidden conservative, there's no overt conservative bias. We're a legitimate standard academic center. We bring in speakers and do research all across the political spectrum.
And Gene's main point, though, was asking about confidentiality of the data, how the demographic parts of your survey are going to be used.
Yeah, so the survey, like all these surveys, is anonymous. No students will have any identifiable information that will be available to anybody. In fact, I won't even see any of it. Our lead designer will erase all of that before we look at the data. Doesn't strike me as any more of a concern with this survey than any other survey that's done anonymously.
Gene, thanks for the call. Will you be able to do, I know often in survey research there are the crosstabs, so you could say students who identified as Democrats were more likely to think this versus Republicans and so on. Will you be able to use the demographic data in that way?
Yeah, so that's the point of having the demographic data. You know, is there a difference between males and females, or people who have a different sexual identity? Are there differences between people of different political identities? Are there differences between, you know, that's what you have the demographic data for. So it's routine, standard sorts of questions. It isn't at all unusual to ask about that if it has relevance to the subject.
Let's bring on another caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Two Rivers. Mark, hi.
Okay, good afternoon. I just was wondering if anybody had caught the irony here that a survey
seems to be delayed for fear of what it's going to say. Oop, We lost your connection, Mark. Started off great, got muffled. Our producer says the summary, Mark sees it ironic that a survey on free speech is being delayed over concerns about how it will be received. And I had asked earlier, Tim, about how it might be used as a political football there. Do you see that as ironic in some ways, as I think Mark was saying?
Well, I guess I do, too. Wisconsin University System is famous for its sifting and winnowing plaque, the fearless exploration in the search of truth. And it seems like being fearful in the search of truth is preoccupying some people.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Sorry we lost the connection there, Mark. Tim joins us now in New Berlin. Tim, hi.
Hi, thank you. I'm interested because your guest seems to be awfully concerned about free speech on campus, but on the grade school and high school campuses around the state, there's a great deal of attack on free speech. A lot of school boards want to get rid of To Kill a Mockingbird. They want to get rid of Harry Potter. They already have in Wisconsin on campuses. They've gotten rid of books in grade school about climate change. They've eliminated them in some school districts.
Tim, thanks for the call. I know Tim, guest Tim, you've got to focus on one thing. Would you be interested in comparable research on those other campuses our caller was talking about, high school and grade school?
My expertise is at the campus level. But I will say I have concerns about those so-called book bans as well. I mean, as a free speech advocate, unless there's some compelling reason to withhold information from students, libraries shouldn't be withholding books.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Tim Scheel, professor of philosophy at UW-Stout, looking at a survey he is organizing for UW System students on issues of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and how it works on their campuses. Scheduled for last week, delayed now until the fall. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Tim, sometimes when we talk about freedom of speech and expression, we talk about, specific bans or official retaliation for kinds of speech. There are also concerns about more, I guess, climate of speech issues. Does a student feel comfortable airing their views in a particular situation, whether that's a classroom or campus event or that sort of thing? Can you talk about how you try to measure those things in the survey?
Yeah, actually, this is one of the, I think, innovations of this survey. In many surveys, they ask the question whether and how often students self-censored, but they don't ask why. So it's one of the things we wanted to try to improve on in this one. So we've got a variety of scenarios in which we're trying to get at the reasons why students self-censor. There's lots of reasons why people maybe don't speak up in class. A lot of those reasons aren't anything to be worried or concerned about. There's only really a very few reasons to be worried about that. So that's what we want to try to tease out in the data. Are they self-censoring for reasons that ought to concern us, or are they self-censoring for reasons that really aren't really anybody's concern?
Now, I know that at least one Republican state lawmaker expressed concern about the delay, saying, well, hold on, if it's the fall, you're going to be surveying some students who maybe only been there for a couple few weeks at this point. Is a fall survey, do you think, going to be less potentially useful than the originally planned spring survey?
Spring would have been better, for sure. We're talking about what would be a good launch time in the fall, because obviously you're not going to ask campus climate questions of somebody who's brand new to campus climate. Maybe we would have to go with only having upper class students, not asking the new students. So that's a question the research team will have to consider very carefully.
Now, I know there's been some reluctance from some, it seems, leadership on various campuses around the state, some faculty to going ahead with the survey. What would you say to your academic colleagues in particular to make the case that, this is something that ought to happen?
Well, I guess you have the choice of policymakers making decisions based on some kind of data or making decisions based on no data. Currently, it's no data. So as an academic, I'm hopeful other academics would like decisions to be based on some data.
What is the road ahead for this survey now? There's been some hullabaloo about this already. A lot can happen between now and the fall. What are your steps? What's your timeline to trying to advance this thing and make it happen in the fall?
That's a hard question to answer right now. We're in conversations with system. We're in conversations with the research team. We're in conversations with faculty across the state and students. You know, it'll take a couple weeks at least to plot the right path forward.
And outside of the survey, Tim, I know free speech and freedom of expression are issues that are near and dear to your heart. What are you hoping people are thinking about on college campuses between now and this survey when it comes to our respect for freedom of speech?
Well, you know, it's often been said it's not human nature to appreciate free speech. You know, we tend to believe we're right and the other person is wrong, and they're so wrong, they shouldn't be allowed to spread their false views. So you're asking for people's better nature to accept the idea that they should tolerate ideas they disagree with, ideas they find maybe very offensive. It's not an easy step for us all to make, but that's the step we need to make, especially at a university campus. It's going to be research that you don't like. There's going to be conclusions researchers reach that you may not like. But that's the sifting and winnowing promise of the UW system. We gather the evidence, we sift and winnow it, and it's all part of the continuing attempt to get closer to the truth.
Tim, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Timothy Scheel is professor of philosophy at University of Wisconsin-Stout, director of the Bernard Center for the Study of Institutions and Innovation. He was with us today to share more about the UW system's delayed free speech survey he's helping to organize and implement on college campuses around the state, originally scheduled for last week, now scheduled for the fall. Here's a fun conversation coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Our sense of smell still has a lot of mysteries. Check out the latest science behind the scent. That's tomorrow at 8:30 here on the Ideas Network. What's the most popular kind of pet in every state? Easy, it's going to be dog or cat, right? But what if you leave out the cats and dogs? What's the next most popular pet? Google Trends has their answer to that question, though I'm kind of skeptical. They went state by state using search requests for different kinds of pets. Here in Wisconsin, our number one non-canine, non-feline pet by that standard is the guinea pig. Okay, maybe Michigan agrees with us on that. Our other three neighbors, Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, all pick chinchilla. All right. And like the entire southeastern part of the country says, bearded dragon. Like that's a common lizard pet, but really? Also, I noticed something missing from all of these, bird and fish. Now, maybe if you want bird, you don't search bird. You search a Norwegian blue parrot, lovely plumage, or whatever specific bird you want. Same with fish. Also not showing up at the top of the list in any state, ferrets. Happy National Pet Day. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, the Wisconsin Film Festival recently aired a restored version of the 1946 movie The Best Years of Our Lives, which earned famous UW-Madison graduate Frederick March an Oscar. Talk about March's life and the controversy over the removal of his name from two UW campus buildings. Now, a new documentary explores great religious architecture in the United States. The Washington National Cathedral in D.C., the Air Force Academy Chapel in Colorado, the Mormon Tabernacle in Salt Lake City, and religious buildings in Wisconsin, like the Annunciation Greek Orthodox Church in Milwaukee, designed by Frank Lloyd Wright. The filmmakers say that religious architecture is trying above all to tell a story. Mike Trinkline is a co-founder of the film production company Betcher and Trinkline, Inc. His latest film is the documentary Secrets of Sacred Architecture, which airs on several Wisconsin channels. Starting today, Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
What led you on this tour and then sharing it with us of religious buildings around the United States?
Oh, I think my co-producer, Steve Betcher, and I have been going to church our whole lives. And, you know, when you're a little kid and you get a little bored in church, you look around and wonder, what's all this stained glass doing here? Why is it designed this way? And as you move from church to church and they're so different, you try to understand what it's all about. And I think that kind of led us to want to make this film.
What kind of places did you find close to home here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I mean, Wisconsin, the nice thing about Wisconsin is that, like pretty much every part of the country, there's an example of every really kind of church architecture right within any given city. And so there's all the various samples. There's great Gothic churches. There's great Romanesque churches. There's all kinds of beautiful styles and more modern styles as well. But I think the one that was really interesting to me locally was Annunciation, this church in Milwaukee built by Frank Lloyd Wright. And it's like this bowl, and then on top of the bowl is another bowl that's upside down. And it's so Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, he was very much into sort of egalitarianism. And so everybody in that church is close to the altar. No one's more than 60 feet away. Of course, the downside, like every Frank Lloyd Wright church, it leaks. That's always the problem with his work.
That's part of the story you're trying to tell in the documentary, I think, is how these churches and their architecture tells a story. How did you unlock that? How did you help interpret what the visual that I might see and say, oh, yeah, it looks cool, what story it's telling?
Yeah, even if you're driving by at 50 miles an hour, churches are trying to talk to you. And just to sort of understand that language can just make things that much more fulfilling. I mean, here's an example. Steeples. Why do churches have steeples? Well, some people might say, when I was in, you know, kindergarten, they would say, oh, they're pointing up to God. And they do. That's part of it. But the other part of it is they're really serving the same function as, say, the McDonald's arches. They're saying, hey, we're here. Check us out. We've got a story to tell. That's a good story. You want to be a part of us. And we've got the tallest steeple in town. And we're here. And it's sort of a marker of a particular church community.
Those are the big things you might see from the outside. Did you find some cool little nuances that you might have even walked by if you're visiting and not making a documentary?
Yeah, here's my favorite one. So a typical church in Wisconsin has stained glass windows, and in those windows are depicted various Bible scenes. Well, it costs a lot of money. Tiffany made a lot of those windows. They're very expensive. So a church would find a well-off donor who would pay for the window. What Tiffany would do, and all the stained glass companies, is they would say, huh, why don't we take the face of the donor and make him, in the church window, say the Apostle Paul or Peter? And so a lot of these church windows actually have real people from the congregation depicted. Now, that was 100 years ago. It's been forgotten. No one remembers that when you walk into the church, that guy up there is actually a guy who used to be a member of the church. So it's just kind of funny how there are people kind of finding these things out, rediscovering that little tidbit of history from days gone by.
Now, to narrate this story, you reached out to someone very familiar to public television audiences and to Star Trek fans, LeVar Burton. And it turned out he was really on the same page as you guys. What did he say when you asked him to do this?
Yeah, he was happy to do it and ecstatic about doing it. He did study for the ministry at one point in his life. And, you know, he's a favorite for PBS audiences and just a guy who was really great to work with and really sort of took on the task of really making this shine. And I think he was a great choice.
As we wrap up, Mike, can you talk about what you're hoping people come away with after they watch the documentary and how they look at maybe their own congregation's building or others in their community?
Oh, yeah. I mean, churches were built to tell a story, and a lot of times the story is sort of a mystery to the people who walk in the church. They've sort of always done it and haven't really looked critically. So once you watch the film, you'll walk into your own church and go, oh, that's why that is, or that's tying to something 1,000 years ago, or that's tying to something 2,000 years ago. There's all these little subtle cues in every church that are connecting to something larger. And that's really what the film is hoping to unlock for people. There's a bigger picture here, and you can really get a more fulfilling experience if you know what all those little details tie back to.
Mike, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Mike Trinkline is a co-founder of the film production company Betcher & Trinkline, Inc. He talked to us about their latest film, the documentary called Secrets of Sacred Architecture. That airs on Channel 36 WMTV today. You can watch it on Wisconsin Public Television on April 18th. Look online for your local public TV station to find out when, where, and how. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about a one-hit wonder from Stoughton.
So what are some of your early memories of rock and roll? For Stoughton's Bill Amundson, there's one that happened really close to home, like right down the street.
It was a normal Saturday spring morning at the Amundson household on Norris Street in Stoughton, Wisconsin.
This is Detective Huckleberry Hound.
The year was 1960, and I was a 7-year-old boy watching Huckleberry Hound when my dad burst into the room. He said, "The band that's on the radio, they're practicing in the garage right down the street." He then proceeded to hustle my brother and I down to the old Hanson garage, where we had a front row seat to a rehearsal by Stoughton's very own one-hit wonders, the Fendermen.
Good morning, Captain. Well, good morning to you.
Phil Humphrey was living in Stoughton, working as a truck driver and taking classes at the UW when he met Jim Sundquist of Niagara, Wisconsin. The two quickly bonded over their Fender guitars and the unusual fact that they shared the same birthday, November 26th, 1937. They formed a duo, dubbed themselves the Fendermen, and began playing gigs at small clubs and bars around southern Wisconsin. Their set was mostly country and rockabilly standards, but they couldn't help but notice that folks went wild for their rather unhinged cover of the old Jimmy Rogers song, Blue Yodel No. 8, usually called Mule Skinner Blues. They tried selling the 45 on their own, with little luck, until a lacrosse DJ named Lindy Shannon became obsessed with the song and played it into their local top 10. From there, it was picked up by the Soma label out of Minneapolis, who released it nationally and sent it soaring into the Billboard Hot 100, where it reached number 5 in June of 1960. By the end of the summer, Mule Skinner Blues had sold well over 1 million copies. The song itself was unusual. It featured just the two Fendermen, drenched in echo, no drums or bass, with Humphrey's delirious whooping and yodeling. Highlights included a number of deranged yuck, yucks, and ha-has, and concluded with the classic cha-cha-cha. As the song took off, the now four-piece band continued to rehearse in that old garage on Main Street in Stoughton, and we kept a lookout for them so we could gather outside at a moment's notice. Mostly, we just stared in reverent jaw-dropping awe, not believing our luck. After all, the Fendermen, although practically teenagers themselves, were the biggest celebrities any of us had ever seen in our short, small-town Stoughton lives. By summer's end, they'd opened for Johnny Cash and Kitty Wells and appeared at the Grand Old Opry. A performance on Dick Clark's American Bandstand would follow, where they shared the bill with teen heartthrob Bobby Darin, who seemed downright subdued by comparison. And then, just like that, it was over. They released a full album called, you guessed it, Mule Skinner Blues, and continued to play as a popular live act. But amidst legal wranglings with their record company and without a follow-up hit, they disbanded in 1961. But Mule Skinner Blues lives on. To date, it has sold over 4.5 million copies worldwide and is a staple on oldies radio stations everywhere. The Fendermen may have provided Stoughton with only a footnote in the history of American music, but they made a lifelong rock and roll fan out of one 7-year-old living just around the corner on Norris Street.
Bill Amundson is an artist and rock and roll fan from Stoughton, and his essay was originally published in the Stoughton Courier-Hub. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Colbert.
Coming up, we'll find out why the name of actor and famous UW-Madison alum Frederick March was removed from two UW campus buildings and the pushback that decision has gotten in the years since. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. The Wisconsin Film Festival screened a newly restored version of The Best Years of Our Lives last week. The 1946 film earned actor and UW-Madison graduate Frederick March an Oscar for Best Actor. March's history at UW-Madison, though, has been the subject of controversy in the last few years. In 2018, UW-Madison removed his name from a campus building after he was found to have been part of a student honor society with the name Ku Klux Klan. UW-Oshkosh followed suit in 2020. A UW investigation found the group had no known ties to the larger racist Knights of the Ku Klux Klan organization. After the name changes, prominent historians and civil rights advocates have argued removing his name was a mistake. George Gonis is a freelance journalist and public historian who says UW got this decision wrong. George, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Good to be with you.
Before we get to the back and forth over the name removal, can you remind us, for those who didn't follow his career, who Frederick March was?
Frederick March, he's a Racine native. He graduated from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1920. He continued to be in touch with the university in big ways his entire life. He is considered one of the great seminal actors of the 20th century. When you talk about the actors of the 20th century, it's usually Spencer Tracy and Frederick March, both Wisconsin products. He's still the only actor in history to win two Oscars and two Tonys for Best Actor. No male actor has done that to date. Of course, you mentioned that he won the Oscar for The Best Years of Our Lives. He's also appeared, and this was no accident, in one socially conscious film after another, because that was his lifetime agenda. So The Man in the Gray Flannel Suit, 7 Days in May, two pro-Jewish anti-Nazi films before the war started, Victory, and So Ends Our Night. One of his last films was Tick, 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 with Jim Brown as an African-American sheriff in a southern small town, and Frederick March being the small town mayor. And he purposely came out of retirement to do that film because the topic was so important to him.
And you write in a piece you wrote about this whole controversy that he was an ally to the civil rights movement off the screen. Can you talk about that as well?
Very much so. In fact, it's a towering resume. He was for more than 50 years, he was one of the more public advocates on behalf of racial justice. He had a 30-year intimate close alliance with the NAACP. He was one of the founders of the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League in 1936 with Dorothy Parker and Oscar Hammerstein, two other racial justice firebrands. In 1939, seminal civil rights event, Marian Anderson, the great opera singer, contralto, African-American woman, is refused. They refused to allow her to perform in Constitution Hall. And so the NAACP starts sending out hundreds of telegrams to try to recruit noteworthy people to come out on Marian Anderson's behalf. The response to these hundreds of telegrams is pretty much, we can't get involved in anything so controversial. There are only 4 Hollywood and Broadway stars who partake in this after those hundreds of telegrams. Katharine Hepburn, Tallulah Bankhead, and Frederick March and his wife, actress Florence Eldridge. March and his wife were performing in a anti-Nazi play on Broadway, The American Way, a play fighting anti-Semitism, and they made sure that they flew from that performance in New York to D.C. to be at Marian Anderson's concert, and they were actually, they appear as sponsors on that famous Lincoln Memorial concert that Marian Anderson gave to push back against the Daughters of the American Revolution, keeping her from performing the Constitution Hall. Frederick March was an elemental part of that. In fact, he and his wife and Marian Anderson were friends for the rest of their lives, both involved in civil rights activities and just socializing, having barbecues at each other's home.
Now, the controversy came out about Frederick March's membership in a group, I believe his senior year at UW-Madison, a group that called itself the Ku Klux Klan. What did you find when you looked into that?
Yeah, but part of the problem in this saga all along has been the name, Frederick March's name was stripped both in Madison and at UW-Oshkosh before any actual research was done into the nature of that Honor Society and the origin of its name, let alone Frederick March's actual 50-year career in civil rights. And so the name has been kind of mischaracterized and misunderstood from the beginning. I think a good way to start out might be thinking about this might be taking a lesson from the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP. A couple of years ago, in fact, this has been in the national news for over the last two or so years, there were WPA murals in a San Francisco high school that a large group of people condemned because they felt those murals celebrated racism, slavery, and genocide. But the San Francisco chapter of the NAACP said, wait a second, we need to do research here. And the NAACP took it upon itself to do that research and discovered that the artist who undertook those murals was in fact a racial justice firebrand himself, and in fact that the murals were a critique of racism, slavery, and genocide in America, and said absolutely those murals, and along with one of the alums, the great actor Danny Glover, also agreed with the NAACP, those murals need to be maintained. The lesson here, how it attaches to the Frederick March situation, is the NAACP in San Francisco just came out and said, you know, things aren't always what they first appear to be, which is why you need to do thorough research. And I would guess another comparison might be the swastika shape, which is, of course, since 1930s on, has been about as poisonous a symbol as you can think of. And yet for centuries through today, it's also a benign and ubiquitous symbol used by the Navajo people and many cultures in Africa and Asia. So with those two examples in mind, some of the leading progressive civil rights and Klan historians have weighed in on this, Frederick March is the name origin of this honor society. And so, and this includes people like Ray Arsenault, who's the John Hope Franklin Professor of Southern History at the University of South Florida, Stephen Whitfield of Brandeis, Robert Goldberg at the University of Utah, and maybe most importantly, Lonnie Bunch III, who's the Secretary of the Smithsonian. He's the founding executive director of the John Lewis Berth National Museum of African American History and Culture. And all of these scholars have determined that March's Honor Society only very coincidentally shared a name with the terrorist hate group. That the name of March's Honor Society actually predated any national awareness of the so-called, what historians call the Second Klan, aka the Invisible Empire, the group that terrorized the country later in the 1920s. And in fact, that this Honor Society was exactly what it said it was, an honor society designed to, pretty much asking each fraternity on campus to nominate its outstanding junior year campus achiever. And that's what it was. And if I may.
We just have a couple minutes left, and I want to share a statement from the Wisconsin Union this afternoon. They said March's contributions to the civil rights movement were considered when they decided to remove his name. And I'm going to quote, they say, overwhelmingly, community members and visitors expressed strong objection to naming a student performance space after any individual connected with a group bearing the name Ku Klux Klan, regardless of the group's functions or actions. They go on, they took into account that it wasn't related to that National Knights of the Ku Klux Klan. So what do you say to their response there? And we just have a minute and a half left or so.
I would say, for one thing, that's just not how things unfolded. March's name was removed. There are two biographies written about Frederick March, which document his social justice activism. University officials at both universities told me those were never consulted at the time. They also never consulted the Frederick March papers filled with letters from Roy Wilkins, the NAACP executive director, who invited Frederick March to be the keynote speaker at the 10th anniversary celebration of Brown versus Board of Education in 1964. The Frederick March papers, just 30 yards across the street at the revered Wisconsin Historical Society, were never consulted. These dozens upon dozens of civil rights histories by Pulitzer Prize winners were never consulted. Frederick March's name is in the index in all its protagonist glory in all of those. They did not talk to people that I talked to, like Harry Belafonte, Ed Asner, who was living at the time, people who knew Frederick March, who were contemporaries of Frederick March, whose lives overlapped with Frederick March. The decision to remove March was there were only accusations, false accusations, that he was a white supremacist and a Klan member. No one making those accusations, no one responsible for removing his name, searched those books, searched the Frederick March papers, interviewed these Pulitzer Prize winning professors who have studied the Klan, who've studied Frederick March. That never happened. So when the university produces that statement, it's not a true statement. And I guess for me, to close out perhaps, the supreme irony is that Frederick March's 50-plus year civil rights resume monumentally dwarfs that of any of the individuals responsible for both removing his name and keeping it off both theaters on both campuses.
That's George Gonis. Thanks for joining us today with us to talk about the life of actor and UW-Madison graduate Frederick March and why he says the decision to remove March's name from two UW campus buildings was a mistake. You're listening to Central Time.